Okay, this class is dedicated in memory of what's her mother's Hebrew name? Chana Bas Avram, right? Okay, so Neshama should have its elevation, and she should be a good advocate for her family and for everybody.
Amen.
Okay, we're on 894, three lines from the end of the page. We're in the middle of the sacrifices and the holidays and the Yom Tevim, the what's called the Korban Musaf, the additional sacrifice that they brought in the temple, in addition to the daily sacrifices which were brought. So we learned that on the 15th day, they brought the various 15th day of Tishrei, which is the holiday of Sukkot, they brought the various korbanos. Okay, but the sacrifices were brought throughout the duration of the holiday. Now in Sukkot, biblically, the first day was holy, the last day was holy. Outside of Israel, you have 2 days and 2 days. But in Israel, the first day of Sukkot was holy. The rest were called the Chol HaMoed, the intermediate days. And then you had the last day, which would be Shmini Atzeres and Simchas Torah. Okay, so just to go quickly, because these are basically the same with a few issues that we'll discuss. Right. On the second day of the holiday, Parim B'nei Vakar, they would bring 12 young bulls, Elim Shinoyim, 2 rams, Kvasim B'nei Shana, 14 male lambs within a year old, Tamimim complete without any blemishes. Minchasim and Niskehem, and their meal offering, they brought flour with each sacrifice, and their libations, meaning the pouring of wine that they would also pour on the altar when they brought the sacrifices. Laparim La'elim, for the bulls and for the rams, V'lakvasim B'misparim Kamishbat, based on the proper amounts as required, like we learned before. I'm just going to read, and then I'm going to read basically the whole page and then discuss it. But Yerim Ashlich on the third day, Parim Ashlich also, there were 11 bulls. So every day it went down. The first day, the Torah says, were 13. Second day was 12. The third day, 11. Okay, Elim Shoyim, the 2 rams. Kvasim and Eshana, the 14 sheeps. A sheep, Abbas and Tamimim, 14 were whole. Umachasim and Eskam, their meal offerings, their libations, Laparim La'elim, Akfasim and Sparim Kamishpat, was basically as required. Sir Chata Sechot, one he goat for a sin offering, Mavad Eila Sataman, in addition to the daily sacrifices, Uminchasa and its flower offerings, and its Nisko, the libations. Okay? Then it says, Abayim Avi, on the fourth day, Parim Asara, where 10 bulls, 2 rams, Kvasim and Eshon Abasa Tmimim, 14 lambs, okay? Mechasim, again, it's the exact same thing, except going down in descending order. Mechasim and Eskeyam, their flower offerings, their libations, La Parim La'elim, La Kvasim and Esparim Kamish, but again, the same thing. Sir Izim Echot Chatos, one of them, well, one goat was brought as a sin offering, Bavada Ila Satam, in addition to the daily sacrifice, Minchasa Viniska, and its meal offerings and its libations. Bayama Hamishi, again, Parim Tisha Elim Shnaim, went down to 9. Okay? Kfasim and Eshana Basa Tumim, 14 sheep. Minchasa Viniskam La Parim La Elim, Kfasim and Sparim Kamishpat, again, the same meal offerings, flower offerings, and all that. Sircha Tos Echad, there was one goat as a sin offering, Melvad Eila Satamin, in addition to the daily sacrifices, Minchasa V'Niska. Okay? Vayayim HaShishi, on the sixth day, I'm just coming to the finish of this, and then we'll talk about it. In the sixth day, there were 8 bulls, 2 rams, the 14 sheep, again, the pourings and the libations and all that, according to the amount. Sirchat HaSechot, one goat as a sin offering, Melvad Eila Satamin, in addition to the daily sacrifices, minchasa unsocheha, its flower off, its libation, its flower offering, and its libations.
How come is this?
We're going to see in a second. B'yayim Ashvi, on the seventh day, parim shiva elim shnoyim, were 7. Kvasim neishon abasa tumim, 14 sheep. Mechasim neskem again, lamparim la'elim, kvasim nisparim kamish batom, like its law. Sirchat Tosachot, one goat for a sin offering. Movada is a tom and chosin in this. Okay? So basically, these were the additional sacrifices that were brought during the holiday of Sukkot. Okay? Now, many of the sacrifices were the same daily, like the 14 sheep, every day. two rams every day. The bulls went down. It started on the first day, 13 bulls, 12 bulls, 11 bulls, all the way down. And the seventh day, which when the Sukkot holiday is over, it went down to 7 bulls. Okay, so it started 13, the next day 12, okay? Now, to explain what this whole concept is over here, with the going down, and we'll see a very interesting thing that the Talmud derives from this, that we pour water on the altar during the holiday of Sukkot, that we'll see in a second. The Talmud says, if you add up 13, 12, 11, 10, 9, 8, and 7, it equals 70. Okay? So the 70 bulls brought on the holiday of Sukkot corresponds with the 70 nations. Okay? Our sages tell us there's the Jewish nation and there's the 70 Gentile nations. That happened, that originated after the flood when they made the what's called Migdal Bavel, the Babylonian tower, to go fight God, so to speak, and God spread the language out and made 70 nations. So at that time, the world became based on 70 nations. Today you have zillions of nations, but they're all part of the original 70 nations. Now the 70 bulls that the Jews brought in descending order corresponds to the 70 nations. And in fact, the sages tell us that if the nations of the world would only know what the benefit the temple did for them, okay, being then the 70 bulls corresponding with the 70 nations, not only would they not destroy the temple, they would keep armies 24/7 around the temple, making sure nobody would touch it. Okay, they would, in Jerusalem, they would just surround the temple. They would, if they would have known what the temple would do for them, they would never allow the temple to be destroyed. And not only that, what?
So why don't they know?
Because
why
they don't know. They don't know. They don't care. One sec.
They didn't come to the shul.
They didn't come to the class. Yeah, what do they know?
So many times, like, they learn that the whole thing with Bill and Amal, they understood the power of the Jews and they understood everything. So why not this?
Because as Rashi quotes earlier, Esav hates Yaakov. The non-Jews hate the Jews. That's it. The bottom line. You see today anti-Semitism all over the world. Okay? It's not only in Iran. It's not only in Syria. All over the world, people hate Jews. That's the bottom line of it. But if you notice, the Torah says that the bulls are in descending order. Not ascending, descending order. Why is it descending order? So the sages tell us to show that the power of the non-Jewish people, when it comes to the temple, gets less and less and less and less. But if you notice, it doesn't become zero. It goes down to 7. Which means God doesn't want evil to be destroyed. God wants evil to be transformed. In other words, the ultimate accomplishment is not to bulldoze evil and get rid of evil. The ultimate accomplishment is not to get rid of your enemy. The ultimate accomplishment is to get your enemy to become your friend. And like we explained before, because then not only it's you against them, but they are working with you. So then it's double power on your side, rather than just negating them and getting rid of them. So the Rebbe points out that the whole concept of the downsizing of this corresponds with the 70 nations. But there's a very interesting thing. We mentioned it last week and we said we're going to discuss it this week. When it comes to the holiday of Hanukkah, okay, so we know, everybody knows, first night you light 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. Everybody knows. But it's not so simple. That's the opinion of Beis Hillel. Beis Shammai, the school of Shammai, maintained, no, you don't do the Hanukkah candles that way. He said, on the first night you light 8, then 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. So according to Shammai, Hillel, the way we do it, the first day you light 1, second day 2, 3. But Shammai says, no, you don't light 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. You light 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. Okay? So simply the Talmud says two reasons for that. One is, Beis Shammai says, we're showing how many days left to Hanukkah. 8 days left, 7 days left, 5 days, you know, whatever it is. Beis Hillel says, no, we're talking about how many days of Hanukkah we have. But then the Talmud says another reason. Beis Hillel says, why do you go up? Because in holiness, you're supposed to go up. Right? In evil, you go down. In holiness, you're supposed to go up. But, why did Beis Shammai say go down? So listen to this. Beis Shammai says, just like the bulls on Sukkot went down, so Hanukkah also goes down. I mean, like, it's far-fetched. Seemingly, what does Hanukkah candles have to do with the bulls of Sukkot going down in descending order? Okay, so like, what is the connection between Hanukkah and Sukkot? Sukkot is a biblical holiday, Hanukkah is a rabbinic holiday. What do sacrifices in the temple have to do with lighting the menorah in our houses today? I mean, like, what's the connection? So it's explained, interestingly, Pesach, biblically, is 7 days. Sukkot, counting Shmini Atzeres, is 8 days. And Chanukah is 8 days. So there's only two holidays of a year, one biblical, one rabbinic, that have 8 days. Sukkot and Chanukah. What is the connection between Chanukah and Sukkot to the number 8? Okay, so we learned in various different times, in classes and stuff. Time is divisible by 7. There's 7 days in the week. The 8th day is Sunday. It's the first day of the next week. So time is divided into 7. 8, our sages tell us, represents the supernatural. Okay? In fact, we learned this in the past. We know if a baby is born on Shabbos, you do the circumcision, the bris on Shabbos. Even though you're really desecrating Shabbos, you're cutting, you're causing bleeding. I mean, the actual circumcision itself is desecration of Shabbos. Okay, so in Halach it says, because the Torah says you got to do it on the 8th day. You have to do it so it's even Shabbos. But Kabbalistically, why is it like that? So Chassidus explains, circumcision is on the 8th day. Shabbos is the 7th day of the week. Shabbos represents time, which is time and place. Bris Milah, circumcision, on the 8th day represents the infinite, the supernatural. And because circumcision, therefore, is on a higher level than Shabbos, it even desecrates Shabbos if it's a natural birth and the kid's healthy and so on. 8 represents, our sages in Kabbalah teaches us, 8 represents the supernatural. What's interesting to note, the temple candles, the menorah in the Beis HaMikdash, had only 7 candles. The menorah in the temple had 7 candles. Hanukkah is 8. Hanukkah represents a greater level of holiness even than the number 7. Even than the temple, the menorah in the temple. And to add to the point, to add to the understanding of it, the temple menorah, I'm explaining this, we'll see, to explain this whole thing. The menorah in the temple was lit during the day, not at night. It was lit in the afternoon. It was not lit outside, it was lit inside. Chanukah, on the other hand, is lit at night and outside. Right? Huh? Yeah, but the biblical, I mean, rabbinic times, it was al Pesach Beisi mi bachutz, outside, in the street. Right? That's what they wanted. Why? Because 8 represents the supernatural ability and power to illuminate darkness, and not only to illuminate darkness, to transform the darkness into light. That's the power of 8. 7 can't do that. 7 is limited in time. Okay? 7, limitation, light cannot change dark, because light is light, and dark is dark. And if you're limited in dark and light, so light can't change dark. but supernatural, when you go above the limitations, so then you can even transform darkness into light. The greatness of Hanukkah candles is at night, which represents darkness and coldness and dreariness and evil and all that. Outside, in the street, is where you have the ability to kindle the menorah of the menorah of the Beis Hamikdash. So therefore, Sukkis, the holiday Sukkis, is also 8 days, including Shemini Atzeres. It's 8 days. Why is it 8 days? Because Sukkis represents a level of godliness which is above nature. What does it mean above nature? In the laws of nature, head is higher than foot. By most people, not by everybody. By most people, head, intellect, is higher than the emotions, which is higher than the lower parts of the body. That's the way normally it works. But the holiday of Sukkot and the mitzvah of Sukkot is a very unique mitzvah. It's the only mitzvah beside mikvah that your whole body goes into the mitzvah. Right? If you're putting on tefillin, you're using your hand and your head. You light Shabbos candles, you're using your hand. Okay? You learn Torah, you're using your mouth. The only mitzvah, mikvah, but we're not learning about mikvah now, but the only mitzvah that you walk into the mitzvah, that your head and feet are equally in the mitzvah, is the holiday of Sukkot.
That's when I said that. Is that the reader by yourself?
It is concerning six halachas.
Because you go into
but it's still, right, but it's still a continuation. By Yom HaShmini. The Torah still calls it the eighth day of Sukkot. The Torah doesn't say it's a separate holiday. Okay? It's the eighth day from Sukkot. Okay?
But you're out of a Sukkah.
But the Torah, then the Torah should have just called it a separate holiday, the day after Sukkot. The Torah says it's the eighth day, meaning it's the eight, but as we're soon going to learn, it's higher than the rest of Sukkot, because it's number eight. But the whole Yom Tov in itself of Sukkot represents the supernatural. Meaning, you walk into the mitzvah, the head and the toes are equal. That gives a person strength to overcome any challenge, any difficulty, any whatever it is. Because challenges could only exist in a world of limitation. Right? If something's blocking me from getting somewhere, so that thing is limiting me from going where I need to go. But if you live in a world that's not limit, that's unlimited, then that thing is not blocking you. Sukkot represents, obviously we have this concept the whole year, but the holiday of Sukkot emphasizes that the concept of Sukkot is the 8 day, the powers called makifim, the encompassing supernatural powers of the Jews to overcome all evil, to the extent that the 70 nations that represent the fighting against the Jews goes down in strength from day to day. You start 13 and then 12 and 11 and so on and so forth. But that represents the concept of self-sacrifice, that a Jew, through self-sacrifice, can overcome any difficulty that they possibly have. That's exactly what Hanukkah is all about. The self-sacrifice of the few Jews that won the battle and they went in the Beit Temple and they lit the menorah and they lit for 8 days. Why was it 8 days? Because Hanukkah is a time when the Jew has the ability not only to break darkness, but transform darkness into light. That comes from a superpower that a Jew has within them.
Every liberation will come in Sukkot, no?
Right, according to one opinion. In the Gemara, one opinion says Sukkot, another opinion says Pesach. To bring it down in a practical level, what it teaches us is that because a Jew has a neshama, which is a part of God, just as for God, nothing is too difficult, if a Jew reveals that inner strength that we have, which is the godly power that we have, no challenges exist. You can overcome all challenges as if they don't exist. But that's only when the person reveals that inner strength that they have. How do you do that? I'm just thinking now from a practical level. We mentioned this not long ago, and I mentioned this a million times to people when I scream at them, which I like to do. When somebody, God forbid, needs to say Kaddish, okay, they lost a parent, they need to say Kaddish, and they know they need to be in shul every day, yeah, three times a day. Yeah. They make it. They make it.
Oh, okay.
Huh?
They make it.
They make it.
And we are willing to make it.
Yeah, they. The whole day is focused, by the way, yeah, is working out of it. Okay. And not only that, when guys used to travel, when they're in, to say Kaddish, the whole setting of airplane trips, hours, time, schedules, is all based around that. The second the year's over, goodbye Charlie. You don't see them. So you call them up and say, why didn't you come to shul anymore? I can't. So the question, the whole year you came, all of a sudden you can't. What's the answer? The answer is very simple. And this is what Sukkot and Chanukah are all about in a practical, bringing it down to a very practical level. During the year that they need to say Kaddish, their mind is set, I have to be in shul. I have to be there. If the attitude is, I have to be there, how? You'll figure it out. If the attitude is, I must be there, there's no question, I must be there. How? You find the inner power, how to get it. If a person's attitude is, you know, like asking to do, I'll try. You know, I was told many times, I'll try is American bluff. They really want to tell you go, you know where, but they want to be political about it, so they say, I'll try. They're not interested, they're not going to try, they're not interested. Huh?
I think. Well,
they'll tell you, I'll try. Okay? That means American bluff. That's what the Rabbi Chosu once told me when I told him I'll try. He said, that means American bluff. You know, I'll try means, I'm not planning to do it, but I don't want you to bug me, and I want to be nice about it, so I'm going to say, I'll try. That's the difference. That's called, by the way, bringing out inner strength. That when you bring out the inner strength, then all the difficulties fall away. All the difficulties fall away.
What?
The difficulties. Yeah. The inner. When a person makes up his mind, this is the way it has to be. I'm going to tell you another interesting thing. That, you know, Chabad deals a lot with people that become Bali Tshuva, that come, as you call them, the late beginners. When they come back. When a Baal Tshuva is beginning their road of Yiddishkeit, you know, and they have family that's against it, and their friends are against it, and everybody's against it, they have all these doubts and difficulties and challenges, and it's very difficult. Really, it's very difficult. It gets to a point, though, and this you see in people. Once they made up their mind, there's no more doubts by them anymore. As long as they're doubtful, oh, you know, should I be doing this? Shouldn't I be doing this? What? Then the family gets in the way, and the friends get in the way, and everything gets in the way. As soon as they make a commitment to themselves, you know what? This is the way it's going to be. Then all the problems go away. Why is that? Because you bring out an inner strength, which is above nature. It's supernatural. And that supernatural power has the ability to overcome all difficulties. So this is what Chassidus explains. The Rebbe explains this, well, I'm paraphrasing, elaborating on it. But the Rebbe explains in a Maimer, in a Chassidus discourse, that this is the connection between Chanukah and Purim. So Beis Shammai says, just like by the bulls of Sukkot, meaning the bulls represent the evil forces, go down, Chanukah, which represents illuminating the darkness, is also in the same way going down. The darkness is getting weaker and weaker and weaker and weaker.
Getting more? Why not?
No, because Beis Shammai says you go down.
Beis Shammai is going down. But
the first night, it took eight candles to illuminate the darkness. Now seven is enough. 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, whatever. It's enough because the darkness is not that strong. Where does it come from? From the self-sacrifice. From the supernatural. Sukkot represents the supernatural because it's the entire Jew from head to toe, which normally are not equal head and toe. Head is higher than the foot. But when you walk into a sukkah, everything's equal. And this is the connection between Chanukah and Sukkot. And therefore, it's not Beishami just saying, okay, the cows go down, so the lights go down. I mean, like, otherwise, what's the connection? Is that this is the concept of the supernatural power within the Jew. And therefore, when these holidays come about, it's actually the time when we rejuvenate and we relive this power that God gives all of us to be able to overcome it. And therefore, the sacrifices were down in that descending order. But, and this is connected to another interesting thing that Rashi says. You mentioned it, okay? On the second day, it says... On the second day, on page 896, yeah? The second line, the last word of that paragraph is Viniskehem. Okay, the next paragraph is Viniska, Viniska, Viniska. The next one after that, it was Insacheha, right?
Yeah.
So again, it's an extra Yud. So there's an extra Mem, an extra Yud, and then, and Pasuk Lamed Gimel, like five lines to the end of the page of 896, it says Kamishpatam. All the other ones says Kamishpat, and here it says Kamishpatam. So in all the days of Sukkot, there's an extra Mem, Yud, Mem. Okay, second day there's an extra Mem, and the sixth day is an extra Yud, and on the seventh day is an extra Mem. Mem, Yud, Mem equals Mayim, water, which from here, by the way, this is the biblical source of what's called Simchas Beis HaShoeva, when they poured water on the altar for 7 days. A whole year they didn't pour water on the altar, only wine. Sukkot, not only did they pour the wine on the Mizbeach, but they also poured water on the Mizbeach. Now the Tzedukis, the people, the Jews that didn't believe in the oral Torah, in the oral tradition, didn't do it. Okay, and the Gemara told a story about a Kohen that was a non-believer, and he poured the water on his foot instead of on the temple, and they stoned the guy with their esrog. They took the esrog and they stoned the guy with it. But it says that Mayim was poured on the Mizbeach during the 7 days of Sukkot. But the Talmud says that there was no joy like the joy of pouring water on the Mizbeach. The Gemara says, "Mi shaleira simchas beis hasheiva." Whoever didn't see the joy of this festivity of pouring water on the altar never saw joy in their life. It was like on 7 days. The Gemara said they didn't sleep; they only catnapped. They were dancing and singing and juggling, and there was unbelievable joy because they poured water on the mizbeach. Okay, so the obvious question is:
they do every day or do they?
Every day. Every day. The obvious question is, every day of the year, they poured wine on the altar. Now, if you ask anybody, what would you rather have, wine or water? Maybe women would say water. But if you're a man, maybe some women also, they would say wine. I mean, listen, wine is expensive. Wine is a beautiful taste. Wine is, you make Kiddush and Abdullah and get married over wine. I mean, everything is wine. Water. I mean, what's water? Tasteless. Water, halachically, is not called a food. We learned many times, you only make a blessing, a bracha, on water if you're thirsty. If you're not thirsty, you don't make a bracha. You can't use water for anything that you need food for. Because water is not food. Okay? So the question is, why was there not so much joy when they poured wine on the altar, but when they poured water on the altar, wow, that was a big joy. Like, why? It doesn't make sense. It should be the other way. For wine, there should be joy, and for water, no joy. But the answer is like this. It's based on the same concept which we're discussing. Wine, which tastes good, represents understanding. When you understand something, you feel good about it. Water symbolizes doing it with blind faith. Kokabolus il, acceptance of the yoke. You do it, I don't understand it. This is what God wants me to do, this is what I do. Okay? Wine represents Yayin Yisamach Levavenish. Wine makes a person happy. You're able to understand better. You know, so wine is a very prominent drink. But wine represents understanding. Understanding is limited. You could be 10 Einsteins together, and it's still a limited brain. If you want to reach the supernatural, that's with blind faith. With blind faith, you do it because God said so. That connects you to God. Intellect, which is limited, cannot connect you to the infinite God. Finite understanding can never reach the unlimited infinite God. Only blind faith, which is so simplistic and so real, that can reach the person, to make the person reach the water. And that's water.
When you're speaking of supernatural and being in touch with those sorts of things, and you see, you make a decision and that's it, and when you have the faith, how do you know that what you're doing is the right thing? How do you know that you're on that path? I mean, everything that you're saying presupposes that you're on a correct path and that everything kind of follows. How do you know that those are the right decisions you're making? What, I guess, what's guiding one along that
way? For a Jew, it's Torah.
Okay.
Now, when somebody goes to a doctor, and the doctor says, you need to take this medicine, okay? You take it. The doctor says you need surgery, you need open heart surgery. Okay, you get a second opinion. Okay, you get a second opinion. I hope your people should. Both doctors say you need to do it. You do it. Do you know what they're doing? No. Do you know how it works? No. Okay. Did you go to medical school? No. The person doesn't go to medical school. But the way we live is I need to trust somebody who did learn, who did know, who does know. I trust their expertise, because if I'm going to refuse to take a pill until I figure out exactly how the pill works from A to Z, I mean, the guy will die before any he'll ever take the pill, right? So obviously there has to be a level of trust. There's a premise for a Jew. God gave us the Torah. Okay, that's a premise. What the Torah teaches, people, we need to rely on the experts. The people that dedicated their life to study, which is the rabbis throughout all generations, you know, that studied day and night, and they were divinely inspired. And so if a person understands that, listen, as a Jew, God gave me the constitution of life, which is called Torah. For a non-Jew, there's absolutely nothing wrong eating cheeseburgers and pig and everything unkosher under the sun. For a Jew, God says, for a Jew, the constitution is you need to keep kosher, you need to do 613 commandments, which 200 some apply today only. God says, this is when you need the path. So, as a Jew, if somebody says, this is what needs to be done, so there has to be some type of a trust. Just like we trust everybody else. We trust our accountants, we trust our lawyers. No, that's without the malpractice. But we trust, there has to be a certain level of trust to the experts. Okay? If for a Jew, Torah is the guide, then we need to trust the ones that tell us what the Torah says. That if we understand that there's a basis, you know, in Torah that we need to follow. And that's the constitution God gave to a Jew. But like we learned many times, Torah is called light. Torah is light. Light we learned this many times, does not change anything in the room. Whether the lights are off or on, everything in the room is exactly the same. The only thing light does show us where it's safe to go and where it's dangerous to go. But it doesn't change danger and not. Without light, you don't know where you're going. You're wandering in the dark and you can get lost and dangerous, whatever. There's a world that God created, and God said, you know what? I am giving you a light to guide you in this jungle. Okay? This is the light of, that's the Torah. That's what Torah is. We're born, we pass away. For the duration of our lifetime, God says, you know what? There's a world that I created, and I dumped you in the world, for better or for worse. Some people love to sue God for having them, but it's not going to... God has better lawyers than we do. And God says, I am giving you a light. For a Jew, this is the light. This is safe for you to do. This is dangerous for you to do. This is healthy. This is sickening. This is right. This is wrong. For a Jew, the right and wrong of life is based on the light of Torah. Now, if I don't know where the light is, or I don't know because I don't read the language, it's in a foreign language, and I don't read the street signs to know where to go, so I ask somebody who knows the language, and they tell me what the street signs say. That is the power that the Jew has. So once he has that, so then his acceptance of the yoke, this is what God wants me to do. If I understand it, good. If I don't understand it, it's even better. Because then I'm not limiting my relationship with God. I'm doing it, I'm binding myself. God, to me, becomes one. And then it's even... So therefore the Talmud says, the true joy, which breaks barriers, when you're happy, you break barriers of things, behavior that you normally would do, that is the real joy, only when water is poured on the altar, not when intellect, so to speak, wine is poured on the altar, because that's limited. And limitations cannot be true joy. True joy is when you break your limitations and go out of your limitations. That's when you get joy. That's when you can be happy. Otherwise not.
So joy is having blind faith.
In essence, yeah. Because that elevates a person to a status of God. That elevates a person to a status of God. Because they're leaving their human intellectual state, because that's the uniqueness of a human, that we have brains. I mean, animals have brains, but that's instinct. You know, the rationale and the thinking, which is uniqueness of a human being, that, as long as we serve God with our intellect, we are still serving God within the realm of humanity. Well, if you want to reach God, it's by putting our intellect at the side, trusting in faith in God, and then we elevate ourselves from the human state to the godly state. And that's what Sukkot represents, and that's what Hanukkah represents, and therefore there's a connection between Hanukkah and Sukkot.
Rabbi, is the wine and the water. Wine is related to brain and water related to art? Or the
huh? Art?
Yeah, to the love.
Heart.
But yeah.
You have to... I don't speak your Farsi.
To translate it.
Translate. No, wine represents...
To brain.
No, if anything, wine could also represent
because
that.
Because it's going to the...
But the Pasuk says, Yayin yasamach levavenish. Makes a person happy. Whether it's serving God with your feelings, or serving God with our intellect, that's still limited. So our feelings are limited, our intellect is limited.
Love is not limited.
Love
is not limited.
Human love is limited.
Sure.
Human love is limited. Godly love is infinite because God's infinite. So if your soul, which is a part of God, has godly love, that's infinite. There's only a certain amount we love people because we love ourselves more. What are you looking at like that? Yeah.
I don't know that's necessarily true.
Sure. The only one that doesn't?
No.
the Yiddish mama. A Jewish mother, because a child is the parent.
Child is
the parent. It's an extension of the parent. So therefore it's themselves. Fathers are too busy, they have no time for all that stuff. But the mothers have nothing to do with themselves a whole day. Okay. They have time to love the kids. No, but it's really because it's an extension of them.
How do you reach that level without the intellect?
Intellect is only a stepping stone to realize that I need to do it, and then you drop the intellect because it only gets in the way.
Is the ladder to go up? Is the ladder to go up?
The ladder to go up, but then you gotta... Faith begins where intellect ends. Something you understand, you don't have to believe. What?
Ratzonelio?
Say, once something you understand, you don't need to believe because you understand it. Okay? So where does belief begin? Belief begins where intellect ends. Now, if your intellect moves up, because you learn more and become more mature officially, so then the belief starts in a higher level and goes up. But belief, by the way, belief is unlimited.
It's still your intellect will tell you to jump, no?
The intellect will tell you to jump to a point, and then the intellect will stop.
Your intellect will tell you, you have to, okay, you know that it's the right thing to do, but is your intellect talking or wisdom? But if you jump, is going to...
When you serve God out of intellect, it limits the mitzvah. I'll give you a very simple example. Okay? Give you a simple, we've said this many times. Honor your father and mother. It's a biblical commandment. Yeah? It's very logical. Correct? They gave birth to you. They stayed up at you, with you at night. And they took care of you and they raised you, right? So it's very logical to keep that mitzvah. But sometimes logic will dictate that you shouldn't. Okay? If they abuse you, they don't take care of you, they don't want to have anything to do with you, they give you up for adoption, right? Then intellect says, 1 minute, then you don't have to honor them. Correct? But that's, God doesn't say, honor your father and mother because. See, if God says, honor your father and mother because they gave birth to you and they stayed up at night with you and they support you, and then if the reasons don't apply, then the mitzvah doesn't apply. Correct? But God doesn't say that. God says whether we like it or not, honor your father and mother, period. Okay? In many prominent psychologists in the world say that if a parent gives up a kid for adoption, the parent is only a sperm donor. Sperm donor? But the parent is the adopted parent. Right? And therefore, you only have to respect adopted parents, right? Dr. Laura used to say that. I don't know if she's still around or not, but people say that, yeah? That's not according to Torah. Because Torah doesn't say, honor your father and mother, because Torah says, honor your father and mother. That's absolute. It's not connected to Seichel.
So how do you reconcile?
One sec. Sorry. The Torah says, don't steal. This we mentioned many times too. Don't steal. Yeah? Logical. Don't steal. Hey, it's yours. Why should I take it? Yeah? But in folklore, I don't know if it's in other languages, but there was a guy called Robin Hood who stole from the rich and gave to the poor. In folklore, Robin Hood is a hero.
Who's that, Obama?
Today you say that.
Obama steals from the poor and gives to the rich.
Reverse.
In Robin Hood, in folklore, was a hero. According to Torah, Robin Hood was a thief, a ganef, because he wasn't allowed to do what he did. Because God didn't say, don't steal because. God says, don't steal. That's absolute. So if you're going to keep the mitzvah because logically it makes sense, then there are times you're not going to keep the mitzvah. Not with honoring parents, not with stealing, not with any logical mitzvah that the Torah says.
You always find the because.
You'll always find the because where it doesn't apply. Okay? I get it. Don't murder. Don't kill, right? Ten Commandments. Very logical. You go around killing you, I mean, you know.
Yeah, but if somebody wants...
But Hitler thought it was a mitzvah to kill.
If somebody wants to take your life, you have a lot to kill. So
because then the Torah says kill him first. Then the Torah that says don't kill here says kill him first. Okay? But if Hitler, Yimach Shemai, can say it's a mitzvah to kill minorities, and Stalin in Russia can say it's a... Or Khomeini can say it's a mitzvah to kill Jews, or all those guys in the Middle East say it's a mitzvah to kill Jews... That's where intellect leads you. Intellect can lead you. When you do a mitzvah, blind faith, God said, this is the way I want it to be. There's no because. That draws a relationship between the person and God, above intellect, above the realm of humanity, and it places a person in the realm of godliness in a total bond. What did you want?
So how do you reconcile the logic then with a situation like you're saying, like an abusive parent or something like that? How do you? I mean, because intellectually, I think we could argue that, you know.
That intellectually, you're right.
No, but I'm saying how do you reconcile the intellectual aspects of that?
I'll give you another example, okay? Intermarriage. Okay, nice Jewish boy wants to marry a nice shiksa. Okay, everybody knows what a shiksa is? Yeah, everybody knows what a shiksa is. Now, trust me, a lot of shiksas are maybe much nicer than Jewish girls. Less demanding, that's for sure. Okay? For sure. Okay. So a guy will say, listen, you know, what's wrong with marrying a wonderful person? All the Jewish girls I went out with are such snobs, and I'll leave out the other adjectives. And this girl is a beautiful, wonderful, good midas, intellectual, pleasant company, you know. What's the answer to that?
She's still not Jewish.
So?
I see your point.
No, I'm saying, so what?
Okay, yeah.
Does that mean they're a bad person? They could be a very good person. The answer is because God said so. There's no rational. Rationally, intellectually,
you're right.
There's no reason why you shouldn't be able to marry them. They're a wonderful person. Yeah, they're even respectful to the Jewish religion. Yeah? But the bottom line is there's no intellect. God says you cannot intermarry. And that's why, by the way, one of the big problems in today's world is when kids come home from irreligious homes. Kids come home with their shiksis or their shaygis boy, and they come home and the parents are getting heart attacks. Whoa! What? Shiksa! Crazy! So if the kid would have any brains, the kid would tell the parents, and a win argument, okay, because the parents will have no answer to this, he says, what's wrong with marrying a shiksa? What's wrong? A wonderful person, a wonderful human being. So all of a sudden the parents will say, oh, but the Torah says you can't. Yeah? So the kid will turn to the parents and say, 1 minute. The same Torah that says you can't marry out, the same Torah says you have to eat kosher. Do you keep kosher? No. The same Torah says you have to keep Shabbat. Do you keep Shabbat? No. The same Torah says you have to keep put tefillin. I mean, you know, go through the list. Do you keep that? No. So the kid says, so why can't I, what's the difference? And you know what? In the argument, the kid's right. The kid's right. Okay? But what's the answer to this whole thing? The answer to the whole thing, we don't do things because I understand it's wrong. We don't do things because I understand it's right. We do things, and that's the power of sukkahs, the blind faith that a Jew has. This is what God is telling me to do, and therefore this is what I must do. Whether I understand it or not is totally irrelevant. Because, like we learned many times, if you think about it, the wonder is not why we don't understand what God tells us. God is infinite. God is an infinite brain. It doesn't have a brain. God's infinite wisdom. We are tiny, puny, brainless compared to God. Nobody's. So the question is not why we don't understand what God tells us. The question is reverse. How do we think we understand anything God tells us that we think we understand? And the answer is, we don't understand it. We really don't. God gave us the ability. God's greatness is, you know what? I gave you a brain. I want you to use it. I want you to know what you're doing. I want you to understand what you're doing. But that's not why you're doing it.
For what did you brain?
Why?
Why did you give brain?
Because God wants us to think, and that's the uniqueness of a human being. We're not animals. God says, I want you to learn the reasons, but at the same time, in other words, I want you to have wine, but at the same time, I want you to do it for water, not for wine. In other words, I want you to do it. Why is that? Because that connects us in a supernatural level with the infinite God. When we only use finite brains, we are connecting ourselves to a finite level of God. Why should we connect ourselves to a finite level of God if we can connect ourselves to the infinite level of God? It's a much greater thing.
We don't understand that.
We understand nothing.
Nothing. So.
And the more you learn, the less you know.
So. It's the same. Everything is the
what?
Same.
Is it important to forgive our enemies first for our own sake? I'm just curious what your viewpoint is on that.
From a selfish investment point of view, yes. From a selfish investment point, yes.
Okay.
Why? Because God acts with us the way we act to others. Okay? It says in Halacha, before you pray, you're supposed to give some charity. Okay, they quote a sentence in scriptures. What's the philosophy behind it? When a Jew prays, what are we praying for? Health and wealth and happiness and this and that. That's what prayers are all about. Right? We're asking God for our needs. If I work for you and you pay me, I'm not asking you for handouts. I'm not asking for charity. I'm not asking for tzedakah. I worked, I deserve to be paid. Correct? If I don't work for you, and I say, give me money, that's charity. Because you owe me nothing. If I come to you when you owe me nothing, and I say, can I have some money? That's called charity. That's called tzedakah. Okay. So we come to God, and we say, listen, God, you don't owe me a thing. The truth was, God owes us anything? He doesn't owe us anything. We're not fulfilling His mission like we should. The righteous, holy people, it says, they have a right to demand. Because they do everything God wants them to do. But we, come on, realistically, we don't know what God wants us to do properly. Okay? So we come to God and say, listen, God, I want A, B, C, D, E, F, G. Yeah? So God says, oh, hold everything. Let me look at you. If you're a person that gives charity, then I will give you charity. If you're a person that when somebody asks you for charity, you say no, so just think. So God says, what? So you want to pray, tell me why I should give you? If you don't give others, God says to us, why should I give you?
I can give.
Just think about it. No, think about it. If God sees that we don't give, so why should God give us? Okay, number one. Let's take it to what you asked. We always ask God for forgiveness. Okay, now you have to understand. Our existence is dependent on God. We wake up in the morning, that's God waking us up in the morning. We're breathing, because God is allowing us to breathe. We have what we need, God is giving it. We always kvetch, because we always want more. We're Jewish, we want more. But the bottom line is, the necessities of life, God gives us. Right?
He has to give us.
And then we come to God, okay, and say, God, you know, I want you to forgive me. He comes Yom Kippur, you bang your head, God forgive me. Yeah? So God looks down and says, okay, you're asking me forgiveness? Let me see who you are. Okay? God sees if you are, I don't mean you, I'm not talking,
I know.
If you are a forgiving person, then God says, why shouldn't I forgive you? But if you don't forgive anybody, God says, the woman, why should I forgive you? You want to explain, God says, you want to explain to me logically why I should forgive you if you're not forgiving your neighbor? Why? And that's logical. From God's perspective, it's very logical. Why should I help you if you don't help others? Right? If you don't help others, why should I help you? If you're not kind to others, why should I be kind to you? If you're not charitable to others, why should I be charitable to you? If you're not forgiving others, God says, why should I forgive you? So from a selfish investment perspective, it pays to forgive others because then God forgives us. It's not my view, it's the Torah view.
Regardless of the situation.
Listen, what we do to God is worse than anybody can possibly do to us. God, our existence is dependent on God. Yeah? And yet we rebel against Him. That's worse than any enemy can do to us. And yet, we're telling God, forgive, forgive, forgive. A whole davening, you know, banging away, forgive. We want God forgiveness. So God says, no problem. No problem. You want me to forgive you? I will forgive you if you forgive others. I will give you tzedakah. I will give you your needs if you give somebody else your need, their needs. Otherwise, why should God do it?
Because we are human beings. We
make mistakes. The reason is why God has to do it.
Yeah.
Because we're His kids, and yes. God has a halachic obligation to support us.
So, that's it?
What do you mean, that's it?
That's it, yes.
Yeah, we're God's kids, whether we like it or not. God has to support us.
So, that's it. You don't, it's not our hand anymore.
But if you want Him to do it nicely... Not throwing it over the shoulder.
You have to be a good kid.
Want to be a good kid? You share your toys with others, then God says, I'll give you more toys. Okay.